dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who I have come to consider is extraordinarily intelligent about matters involving national security and the common defense of the United States and the free world more generally, is our first guest. He is Benjamin Weingarten. He is the founder and CEO of ChangeUp Media, LLC, very active contributor to the public policy debate, notably through his writings these days at Conservative Review, and you can also find him at PJ Media and elsewhere. He is a 2015 Publius Fellow of an institution I admire greatly, the Claremont Institute, and periodically a guest here, for which we're very grateful. Ben, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thanks, Frank. I appreciate that that very nice introduction, and it's always a pleasure.
Well, let me talk to you about some of the reasons why I think you deserve such a warm welcome. You have been writing very powerfully about Syria of late and raising, it seems to me, the right sorts of questions. And I'd like to ask you for sort of your take on the strike that President Trump launched last week against the Syrian despot's airfield, and more broadly, whether you think what's looming is an effort to remove that despot, Bashar Assad.
Well, I think that you get, on the latter question, you get different perspectives from different folks in the administration, some of whom it seems like are dedicated to a full-scale invasion with thousands of boots on the ground. There's been reporting to suggest that perhaps the focus will primarily be on ISIS and not regime change, but there are others who clearly believe that Assad must go, and not necessarily in some kind of negotiated settlement between all the parties involved. So I think that the administration is probably going through those debates right now in terms of whether or not regime change and regime change pushed by U.S. military action is the right play. Why I think this presents numerous challenges and why I think we need to look at the strike, the cruise missile strike, in context of the broader state of play within Syria is there are no good actors on the ground in Syria. Bashar Assad is certainly not a good actor. The Sunni, quote unquote, militias that are often al-Qaeda aligned are not good actors. ISIS is not a good actor. And of course, Assad's regime is a proxy for Iran, and Iran's militias are on the ground as well. So there's almost no good outcome in terms of who would succeed Bashar Assad, perhaps save for another Alawite representative who would come in and not be as closely aligned with the Iranian regime. But essentially what I think you see is that there are no winners. There are no good guys on the ground from the perspective of the West. And so we better be very confident in our decision making before we go in and engage militarily, given the stakes of what is going on. And I would add that when we talk about evaluating, was the strike good or bad? Was it the right thing in America's national interest or not? I don't think you can look at the strike without considering what all the potential knock-on effects are. On the positive side, given that the president was hosting the Chinese premier Xi Jinping at that point, it's clear that the strike was meant to send a signal to both North Korea, China, and our allies in the region and Asia, that the U.S. will not stand by if our interests are perceived as being threatened, and we will, in fact, use military force. Now, that's a positive. Another positive might be if you believe that the use of chemical weapons is something that it is in America's national interest always and everywhere to make nations pay a price for. And if we are saying that we are going to impose a red line that was not adhered to previously, then you would say this is a reassertion of American military power. But you can't look at all of these positives without considering the negatives. And if we do have a U.S. major military engagement where we're fighting alongside Sunni jihadists and their chemical weapons being unleashed, you can see that there are many opportunities for chaos there, not to mention potentially striking Russian forces, which could lead to a major escalation there as well. So we really need to look at the costs and the benefits when we consider our actions in Syria.
I would say, Ben Weingarten, that you may have overlooked one of the bad actors who I know you're as concerned about as am I, namely the Muslim Brotherhood. Talk a little bit about the role that they've been trying to play, that Barack Obama seemed to be trying to play to bring them to power in Syria, as well as, of course, Egypt and Libya and elsewhere. And why it is, Ben, as best you can tell, that President Trump seems to have deferred, at least, if not backed away from altogether, his campaign pledge to designate this group as what it is, a terrorist organization.
Frank, as you rightly point out, the Muslim Brotherhood is the, as your listeners well know, the tip of the Islamic supremacist spear. And they are in many ways more politically savvy because they differ in their tactics from some of the other groups. And thus it allows them to advance their goals more deeply, both in the Muslim world and in the West. What I would say about the Obama administration's engagement with the Muslim Brotherhood is that the Obama administration sought to make the Muslim Brotherhood the primary Sunni political partner in the Middle East. So on the one hand, we had the elevation of the jihadists on the Shia side with the ascendance of the Iranian regime and the Obama administration's, I would argue, complicity in allowing the expansion of the Shiite crescent. On the other side, you have the Obama administration actively politically partnering, and in certain cases, specifically in Egypt, working with Mohamed Morsi and his allies in the Muslim Brotherhood to help them stay in power. So you essentially had the unleashing of the best organized, quote unquote, political Islamic supremacist force. And that was America's key partner in the region. So that obviously presents manifest issues from the perspective of American national security and the expansion of the jihadist movement throughout that region and throughout the world, not to mention legitimizing the Muslim Brotherhood. And that brings us to today and the Trump administration. And I think what the Trump administration articulated during the campaign was that their goal was to defeat radical Islamic terrorism. And the Muslim Brotherhood was specifically pinpointed as one part of the Islamic supremacist movement. And it's worth noting that in testimony prior to being confirmed as the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson lumped the Muslim Brotherhood in with essentially the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, as well as Al-Qaeda and ISIS. So putting the Muslim Brotherhood, which was the Obama administration's central partner on the Sunni side in the region, on par with other Sunni jihadist groups and Shia jihadist groups, was a very telling and, in my view, optimistic and positive sign. However, we've seen in the months since then that the Trump administration has shelved plans to designate the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization. And I would suggest that if you look at the fact pattern, we can see why they've shifted in this direction. The first point worth noting is that we have sources reporting that $5 million were put forth by the Muslim Brotherhood to undertake a public relations campaign in the West advocating against terrorist organization designation. You had representatives from various Sunni partners in the Middle East, partner regimes and governments, lobbying on behalf of not designating the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization. You had numerous articles being put forth by folks on the left and right in the foreign policy and national security establishment in places like the New York Times, the Washington Post, Politico, Foreign Policy, etc., all advocating against Muslim Brotherhood terrorist organization. And then it should be noted as well that both the State Department and CIA put out reports advocating against it. So you factor all that in, and then you add on the fact that the terrorist entry or immigration executive order has been embroiled in such heavy litigation, and you've seen essentially the rolling or the removal from the administration of those who are most hostile towards the Muslim Brotherhood and view it as a central threat in terms of Islamic supremacism. You factor all those things together, and it's understandable why under such pressure and given the changes in personnel and the alliances that the Trump administration has tried to build and trust these Sunni partners in the region, why they would consider shelving and indeed have shelved to date the Muslim Brotherhood terrorist organization designation.
We have to leave it at that for the moment, Ben. Thank you for these very thoughtful analyses of what is going on at the moment in the Middle East more generally, and also against the Muslim Brotherhood in this country. We'll look forward to your further writings and further contributions to the program. Thanks for joining us. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, Dan Cadman joins us from the Center for Immigration Studies. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Dan Cadman is joining us, I'm very pleased to say, from an organization that I regard very, very highly, the Center for Immigration Studies, where he is a fellow these days. He brings to that job a wealth of experience in the immigration and border security business. He has some 30 years of service to our country as an immigration and naturalization service and immigration and customs enforcement officer, including both in the field and in supervisory and managerial roles. It's great to have him back, Dan. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, there's a lot going on in this part of the battle space of what I think of as the war for the free world. Dan, let me ask you to start by talking a little bit about the state of play with respect to the president's commitment to tighten up immigration. And maybe we could first discuss some directions that the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, has been handing down in this regard. What can you tell us about them and how important do you think they are?
Well, I think they're fabulously important, and the new attorney general has been quick off the mark, which I'm extremely pleased to see, in following up on the president's executive orders. And that comes in at least a couple of very important directions, one being that he's making very, very clear that the federal government is not going to tolerate state and local interference in federal immigration enforcement through actions posturing themselves as sanctuaries. And he's made very clear that federal funds will be cut off to such locales. A second area where he's also been very aggressive, and I think importantly so, is directing the United States Attorney's offices to start aggressively prosecuting immigration-related crimes. And those include people who reenter the United States repeatedly after they've been deported. And this is extremely important, given that most of the people deported these days are criminals. But also identity fraud, which I think will have a very good impact on the workplace and making it more difficult for illegal aliens to work without authorization. And that's hopefully freeing up at least some jobs for lawful workers, U.S. citizens, and resident aliens.
Important promise the president made as well. We're visiting with Dan Cadman of the Center for Immigration Studies. And you were talking a moment ago, Dan Cadman, about the effort to give teeth, I guess, to the promise to end the practice of sanctuary cities. As we speak, there is a ruling expected, I believe, out of California by a federal judge being asked to once again impose an injunction on this initiative. What do you think is likely to come out of that, Dan?
I think probably nothing good, because virtually all of California is a sanctuary state, and the fact that it's a federal judge doesn't seem to matter anywhere within the confines of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. But what I find great heart in is that the administration is now poised to push forward into and through the Ninth Circuit and arrive at the Supreme Court, where hopefully with the addition of Justice Gorsuch, they will have a fair and honest reading on the issue of the law.
Mm-hmm. And this will, of course, also presumably be the case with respect to the executive orders that the president promulgated, two of them, on this whole issue of trying to pause immigration from nations that are best known for sort of their traditions of Sharia supremacism. Do you expect a Gorsuch-reinforced Supreme Court to come down on the right side of that, Dan?
I hope fervently that that's the case. I should certainly think so. Again, an honest reading of the Constitution, it seems to me, is going to give due precedence to the president in his plenary powers over both foreign policy and immigration, which is a uniquely federal prerogative and one in which states should really have very little say. So that's my hope.
Dan Kadman of the Center for Immigration Studies. Let me turn to one of the president's other signature commitments in the course of the campaign and since coming to office, and that is to secure the southern border of the United States. He's actually set about aggressively putting in place the contracts that would give rise to physical barriers along much, if not all of it. And yet we're seeing congressional Democrats determinedly trying to cut off funding for it, even threatening to shut down the government over their objections to this effort. And some in the congressional leadership, at least, seem inclined to go along with them. Tell us what's going on there and what do you think will come of it all?
Well, I tell you that I'm chagrined that, particularly in the Senate, things move so slowly and that Mitch McConnell is so deeply wedded to preserving the filibuster at virtually any cost. He begrudgingly removed that as an obstacle to Gorsuch, but the reality is that everyday legislation that needs enacted, including whether it's appropriations for the border wall or for additional border agents or ICE agents, even to enact legislation that might allow for the taxing of remittances to fund the wall or those agents, are going to go nowhere until the filibuster is removed. That's the reality. Good legislation in the House isn't even going to go anywhere because it bottlenecks in the Senate. So as long as nothing is being done in the Senate, there's a problem.
Does that mean, in your expectation, that we will not see the president's commitment fulfilled with respect to building new impediments to illegal immigration across the southern border?
I don't think it's going to happen as rapidly as we might wish, and I think the pressure is going to build on the Republican majority in the Congress generally and the Senate particularly to show they're capable of governance.
Let me ask you, Dan, as a professional in this space, and again, our guest is Dan Kadman, you've worked for three decades or so trying to secure this country from enemies foreign, from becoming enemies domestic, let me put it that way. When you look at that southern border at the moment and what we're seeing or reading about in terms of narco traffickers coming across it above ground or underground and colluding with terrorist organizations like Hezbollah and Hamas and perhaps the Islamic State, and, you know, the human trafficking and all the rest of it, Dan, what urgency would you attach to trying to shore up that border security? And as a result, how critical should we be of those impeding that effort?
We should be highly critical, and I can't think of anything more important. I believe it was in the Eastern District of Virginia, a Pakistani man was just indicted for a massive smuggling operation that brought Pakistanis up from the tri-border area of South America in Hezbollah-controlled areas of the tri-border region through Mexico and into the United States. And the backgrounds of the people that were being smuggled are most questionable. On top of that, we see Mexico going close to the way of a failed narco state, and that so deeply concerns me. It was bad enough when we saw it in Colombia. This is literally on our back door. We can't afford to allow this to happen.
Amen. Dan Catman, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but look forward to resuming this conversation with you very soon. In the meantime, thanks for the great work you do, you and your colleagues at the Center for Immigration Studies. Keep it up. Come back to us again soon if you would. Next up, we'll be speaking with Dr. Leon Aron, the country's leading experts on Russia and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by Dr. Leon Aron. He is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, where he directs its Russian Studies program. He is also a member of the Broadcasting Board of Governors, an entity in the United States government that oversees its international broadcasting outlets like the Voice of America and Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty. He is the author of numerous books, including Road to the Temple, Truth, Memory, Ideas, and Ideals in the Making of the Russian Revolution. He also edited an important collection of essays entitled Putin's Russia, How It Rose, How It Is Maintained, and How It Might End. Leon Aron, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Good to be here, Frank.
Well, let me ask you most immediately to comment on the meeting that Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, had with Vladimir Putin. Of course, we don't know much about what went on behind closed doors, but you're a Kremlinologist of great renown, accustomed to reading the tea leaves or the entrails or the smoke signals or whatever. Tell us what you think happened behind those closed doors, as well as what you think is likely to happen next.
If the precedent holds, and I think it does, they met for 2 hours, and I am ready to bet a non-existent estate that about 1 hour and 45 minutes of that was Putin's lecture. That's been the modus operandi. You know, about how Russia is for peace, how Russia is abused, how America is wrong, and so on and so forth. And also explaining, you know, where Syria is, what it does, the division. I mean, Putin is very good, you know, at briefing Americans on what's happening.
But that said, Leon, let me just ask you, this isn't John Kerry. This is Rex Tillerson, who is a rather formidable man who knows Putin well. Do you think he would try to, you know, sort of filibuster and rant in that fashion with a guy like Tillerson, especially under these circumstances?
Yeah, I think exactly. That was exactly my point. Well, you know, what was in that black box, we usually know by the press conferences that follow, because Lavrov pretty much follows the line of the boss. And one extremely refreshing thing for me was that we no longer saw the nauseating obsequiousness of John Kerry. You know, as somebody who is paid to watch those post-Lavrov-Kerry press conferences, I was getting physically sick. Anybody could YouTube it. There was a press conference where Kerry started by expressing his delight for being, it's a quote, in the presence of Vladimir Putin.
Not the only occasion that happened with John Kerry, mind you, but that's still appalling.
Yeah. So in that sense, answering your question, you know, Tillerson was refreshing. He was direct. He did not mince words. He told them, he described Assad exactly as he was. There was a part of his press conference with Lavrov. Now, what's interesting about this is that Lavrov is definitely sort of reflected the tonality of Putin's, and that tonality was relatively moderate. So I think that the conversation was relatively, you know, between Putin and Tillerson was relatively civil. But I think probably Tillerson did not wait 1 hour 45 minutes before saying something. He may have started speaking.
But let me just ask you to sort of put a fine point on this, Leon Aron. Is it your judgment that basically Putin was viewing
the United States differently with a Trump presidency and a Rex Tillerson in the role of Secretary of State than he had been accustomed to with Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton and John Kerry and their resets and all the rest?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Which is why, by the way, I was never part of that crowd that that thought that, that Putin was, you know, opening champagne and crashing cymbals when Trump was reelected, much less,
or,
you know,
or colluding to get him elected in the first place.
Exactly. Oh, that is a total nonsense. And we can, you know, we can, it's probably not even worth talking. I mean, I think your listeners know that it's a total nonsense.
Well, there are a few Democrats in Washington who retain confidence that it actually did happen. So I'm happy to hear you dismiss it.
Oh, my God. You know, first of all, you know, the Russian intelligence operatives do not go do not deal with campaigns which until what, a few days, maybe a week before the election, appeared to be doomed.
Well, no, until the day after the election, I think you could actually say appeared doomed.
Yeah. So so far, what's been leaked, and I think that's correct, is that they sort of, you know, crawled around the edges, you know, Manafort, you know, a couple of other people. Yeah. I mean, that's a routine operation, of course. Of course, that's what FSB does. You know, you sort of press and press and push and push.
Yeah, this
but
is, of course,
more
the contemporary KGB.
Putin is an experienced guy, and he knows that you do not go deep with an unknown quantity. And
especially
that is what
when
Trump
you have
is.
A relationship with the known commodity, Hillary particularly.
Yeah, exactly.
So before we run out of time, Leon, I do want to ask you one other piece of this, though, because you've of course, both studied closely and written extensively about and given considerable clarity to what the Russians are up to for many, many years now. But one other piece of your portfolio that I think is particularly important for our audience to hear is your perspective from the vantage point of the Board of Broadcasting Governors. It's a very important piece, or should be, let me put it that way, a very important piece of American statecraft that we're able to communicate effectively with foreign audiences in places like Russia and so-called near abroad and so on. Against the backdrop of what you know and have seen and have written and worried about in terms of Russian influence operations and propaganda and disinformation, how are we doing in that part of the battle space, and what should we be doing to up our game?
Well, Frank, I mean, we've known each other for since the good old days, right, of the Cold War, and it's always been the case that, of course, the Western, the strictly speaking Western propaganda, if such thing is applicable, always lags behind the Soviet propaganda because authoritarian states are better organized for lying in concert, as it were, for presenting and sharpening the views and cutting off all the competing views, both inside and outside. So in that sense, I can tell you, boy, you know, Russia has, you know, RT, which is Russia Today, and we have what? Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. However, again, as in the Cold War, and, you know, I hate to sound hackneyed, but in this case, it's true. The truth is on our side, and this is a very powerful issue. We did launch an extremely, as it turns out, successful 24-hour satellite cyber program called Current Time, Настоящее время in Russian, which is growing its listeners and visitors on the site by leaps and bounds. It's the first 24-hour program.
In Russia?
A joint in Russia and in Russian. And by the way, in Russian means that it reaches Ukraine, in addition to Russia, right? Reaches Ukraine, reaches Moldova, the entire Central Asia, and it reaches the audience that we need most to reach in the Baltics, which is ethnic Russians. That is a very powerful tool We are just measuring how it's doing. It only was hard launched early this year, but so far the signs are good.
Well, this is exciting news because I'm a big fan of the idea that we not propagandize, but we do tell our story. Thank you, Leon, for what you do to help our media, including this program, and I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. It's always a delight to talk with you. Next up, we'll speak with Bill Gertz. We'll take stock of what's happening inside the ring and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined as we have the extraordinary pleasure and privilege of being each week about this time by Bill Gertz, one of the country's preeminent reporters on, well, anything, but most especially in the national security space, which he writes about each week at the Washington Times in his prize-winning Inside the Ring column. And he is also, of course, the editor, senior editor of the Washington Free Beacon. And you can find his great output there, as well as at the Times, at GertzFile.com. Bill Gertz, it's so good to have you. Welcome back.
Hi, good to be on the show.
Well, I want to ask you about a couple of developments since we last talked, Bill, notably two powerful uses of U.S. military weaponry, namely the dropping of the so-called MOAB, better known as mother of all bombs, by some 15 tons of high explosives on a warren of caves and tunnels and so on in Afghanistan yesterday. And last week, the cruise missile attack in Syria. You have a piece up at the Washington Free Beacon from Mike Pompeo, a good friend and often a participant in this program in his previous life, about signal sending. Tell us about all of that, if you would, Bill.
This was specifically dropped targeting some Islamic State in Khorasan. That's the Afghan offshoot of ISIS. They have a network of tunnels located near the Pakistani border. So this was an attempt to try and take out some of those fighters in those tunnels. We don't know how successful it was. Certainly it was another good signal that the military seems to be stepping up, at least the air component of its operations. On the cruise missile strike, yes, the new CIA director, Mike Pompeo, who gave his first public remarks at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and he very explicitly said that the cruise missile strike on a Syrian airfield was designed to send a message to Iran. And he also revealed in the same context that the agency was looking very closely at Iranian compliance with the nuclear deal that was completed in 2015. And the clear implication was if they are not in compliance, that they could face the same kind of a strike on some of their undeclared nuclear facilities.
Bill, I wonder if other recipients of the signals were also intended, though Director Pompeo apparently didn't mention them, but I'm thinking particularly of North Korea. You've written at the Free Beacon, 321, you've written Inside the Ring about the conversation that Donald Trump had with his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping in their summit last week that focused apparently quite extensively on North Korea. Talk about the carrier battle group that is now operating off of North Korean waters and what you think is being sent by way of signals to the North as well.
Yes, the summit last week between Trump and Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader, focused in large part on how to deal with the North Korean problem. And according to White House officials, basically they've determined that there's general agreement that the problem is getting greater, that the North Korean problem is getting greater. And what that problem is that the North is really ramping up its long-range missile programs and its nuclear weapons. They're expected to conduct a underground nuclear test soon, coinciding with the ascension ceremony of the North Korean communist founder Kim Il-sung. And so that's created a lot of worries. The dispatch of the Vincent is part of a new policy of putting pressure on the North Koreans. Trump reportedly, according to the officials, told Xi that, look, you have to step up and do more. You're a client of North Korea. You're the main patron for North Korea, which is your client. And if you don't do it, we're going to do it. I don't think the Chinese are sincere. I think there's a lot of duplicity there. The Chinese have a really strong defense agreement. The defense agreement between the two militaries is that China is obligated to defend North Korea from any attack. And in exchange, North Korea is to consult with all of the things that it does. And if that were the case, then China would say, don't do this nuclear test, and hopefully tensions would die down. But things are pretty hot right now.
Well, Bill, you've reported for years on what the North Koreans are up to and the extent to which they're helped in being a threat, including increasingly to us, from the Chinese. And I'm thinking of particularly the example of these so-called transporter erector launchers that the Chinese gave the North Koreans, which are expected, I gather, to be used not only by the present fairly long-range but medium-range ballistic missiles, but also the intercontinental range ones that we expect will be coming shortly from North Korea. Talk about, you know, the truth here as to how indispensable China's help has been to the threat that they putatively are concerned about, as are we.
Well, the White House has just completed a policy review on North Korea. And contrary to some published reports, the new options don't include a decapitation, assassination of Kim Jong-un, or the reintroduction of nuclear weapons on the Korean Peninsula by the U.S. What's going to happen, according to people I've talked to, is that they're going to increase pressure and very likely will impose what are known as secondary sanctions. That is, they're going to finally target those Chinese companies that have been identified by U.S. intelligence as supplying key technology and equipment to the North Koreans. China for years has tried to say that they were not involved in this and that anything that happened was unofficial, but there's clearly a flow of technology, and it's continuing. And it's not just missiles. It's also the new underwater missile that they're working on, and the new submarine that they're building, a missile submarine that can fire missiles long distances. So those are the real concerns, and we'll probably see that in the coming weeks.
Can you respond to the idea of whether the United States would, in fact, act unilaterally in the absence of Chinese help?
I think that the most we can expect is saber rattling. And if North Korea were to try something preemptively, then that would trigger a second Korean War, and that would not be good for the peninsula. The main reason being so much of North Korea's forces are located so close to the megalopolis of Seoul, the capital. So I doubt that there aren't really any good military options. I think we should use IWAR, information warfare, as I suggest in my book.
Yeah, well, and I do want to commend to our listeners all of your books, but most especially your brand new one, IWAR, National Security in the Information Age. In the last minute we have with you, to ask you about Russian information warfare against this country and how prepared we are to counter it. We were talking a little bit about it with Leon Aaron a moment ago, but give us your thoughts on that.
Well, yeah, it's a huge problem, and the U.S. is very unprepared. We have no capabilities. The only system we have, we're spending $750 million a year on something called the Broadcasting Board of Governors, which is poorly led by non-experts and unfocused. And at the same time, we're under assault from Russia in particular, which is, we saw during the elections, did cyber-enabled influence operations. The Chinese are also doing it. They have their propaganda cable outlets broadcasting on our cable, and yet they refuse to allow our media into their country. So there needs to be a whole new policy. I'm advocating that, and I'm hoping the new Trump administration will follow through on some reforms.
Bill Gertz, thank you so much for your time today and for the great work you do at the Washington Free Beacon, the Washington Times, and, of course, our visits here each week. I look forward to it again next. Look forward to talking to the rest of you again Monday as well. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.